Well, it's going to be a very big day tomorrow because this Essendon thing, Moons, will be over because we're going to get a verdict one way or the other. The Court of Arbitration for Sport is going to hand down its verdict. We're hearing that it'll be early tomorrow morning. The players to find out at around 7:30. The public will find out at around 8:30. And a man that's been all over it and happy to take your calls throughout the hour, 9429 1116. He's written a book on it. It's called The Straight Dope. He'll probably be writing maybe another book after the verdict is handed down, but it is a great read if you want to get hold of it. His name is Chip Legrand. He's from the Australian newspaper, and he joins us in the studio. Chip, thanks for coming in.
Maybe a chapter anyway.
Maybe another chapter. Is it the end tomorrow, no matter what?
Well, look, it's the end. If the players are found not to have taken a banned substance, so if the Court of Arbitration for Sport upholds the decision that we had this time last year from the AFL Tribunal and finds that the case hasn't been established, then yes, that is the end of the matter, that you've got 34 current and former Essendon players who've got a great weight off their shoulders and they can get on with what's left of their careers. Of course, if they're found that they did take a banned substance, you know, the penalties could range from anywhere from pretty much no effective penalty to up to 2 years.
Mm.
Now, you get to the more severe end of that, and it's a big ramifications for not just Essendon, but we've got, five AFL clubs now, where you've got current players among the 34. You've got Essendon, you've got Melbourne, you've got Port Adelaide.
You've got coaches.
St. Kilda, people. You've got the Western Bulldogs, assistant coaches. That's right. So the implications of a guilty finding and a substantial penalty are quite severe.
So if they are found guilty, do you think there'll be any more appeals, or is this it?
Look, you can never say never, but as far as the anti-doping system goes, this is really the end of the road for 99.9% of cases. There is a provision to have an appeal to a federal court in Switzerland, but it's rarely done. And
so that's on the back if the players are found not guilty. That you're saying
I don't think WADA would go there, but it's okay. Look, if the players were found guilty and they were looking, if they wanted to challenge it further, then that's a possibility. Mm. But I would say highly unlikely. I would think that Whatever the verdict is tomorrow, that'll be the final judgment.
Chip, do you know how we talked about the verdict will come in at 7:30 tomorrow morning? Do you know how the players will be receiving this? Are they getting together early, or is it you're waking up to a text message? I mean, that's got to be the scariest text message you'll ever wake up to.
There's not much fanfare. My understanding is that the Court of Arbitration Support panel, is just going to email the parties. So it's not a hearing. It's not like they're gathering in a room in Switzerland, and this is going to be, you know, broadcast or Skype or whatever.
So basically, you wake up, you'll have an email, and you just one email in the box. You're thinking this is do or die.
It is. It's going to be nervous fingers when you're clicking on to read that.
Give us a call if you want to ask Chip a question about all this. I suppose, and it's a you. What's your gut feel at this stage after reading all the evidence? You know that you've got a little bit of an idea of what may have gone on behind closed doors. What is your gut feel on tomorrow, Chip?
Well, look, my feeling is that this has always been a very difficult case to prove. And for the reasons that we've talked about at length previously, mainly because of the nature of Stephen Dank and his work, because he kept such poor documentation, because he's been so unreliable in his public statements since, because the club failed dismally to keep tabs on what was going on. It's really hard to establish sort of, you know, clear, concise evidence of what these players took. I mean, that's been the problem all along.
Yep.
It's been to Essendon's great detriment that here we are 3 years later and we can't say definitively this is what these guys were given. But having said that, everyone involved in this case has said that the World Anti-Doping Agency has done a much better job in presenting the case a second time around than what the Australian Sports Anti-Doping Authority did 12 months ago. They've made the most of the evidence and look, it's probably a flip of the coin in terms of which way it'll go. It's really fraught to read too much into anything that was said by the panel members during the course of the hearing. Of course, the hearing was behind closed doors, so we're just hearing snippets of what was said.
Yep.
There were certain remarks made, and of course, lawyers read into what the panel members are saying at different times. But everyone's really guessing at this stage, so no one knows for sure other than those three members of the panel.
So take us through exactly what has happened the last 12 months. So you get the initial finding, not guilty, so everyone was happy, and then the Court of Arbitration for Sport then puts an email out again. I think it was an early morning email that we're going to appeal. Take it up from there.
Yeah, remember there were 6 weeks. There was 6 weeks between the day when the players gathered down at that pub in Port Albert Park.
That's right.
And they all thought that it was over, finally, and remember them.
Yep.
Talking about the sort of sense of relief and almost anti-climax too, you know, having lived with this thing for so long, mm-hmm. it was off their shoulders. So 6 blessed weeks, they didn't have that hanging over them. And then the announcement from the World Anti-Doping Agency that they were going to appeal. Now,
and you saw their season just drop.
That's right.
They just fell in a bundle, the poor boys.
That's it. They really couldn't, and they admitted as much. I mean, when they had, I think after the St Kilda thrashing, when they got done by about 100 points and they had a meeting with the with James Hurd, who was then the senior coach, and other officials at the club, and they just said, you know, the senior players were saying, we just can't. It's not that we're not trying, but we just can't. Mm. We can't do this anymore. It's just gotten to us. So it was a mess, and we obviously know everything that happened at the club as far as the, you know, the what happened with James Hurd and others and so forth. But then, having decided to appeal the case, WADA weren't. They didn't sit on their hands. They sought to see if they could find out a bit more, if they could strengthen the case, so they could get some new evidence. And the big thing that they did to try to strengthen the case was they commissioned a laboratory in Cologne in Germany to establish a test for thymus and beta 4, which is the banned peptide at the centre of the case, the one that WADA suspects 34 players have taken.
So they still have the samples from back in 2012?
They had urine samples that had been frozen from 2012, and they tested, they had 26 samples tested. These were about 16 Essendon players, so some of them were duplicates.
Yep.
So they developed the test, they had them tested, and 3 of those 26 returned elevated levels for thymus and beta 4. This is according to the WADA case,
right?
And so they felt that was important, that they had some, not, it's not a positive test, but it's more circumstantial evidence that look, okay, this stuff's hard to detect, it's only in your system for a matter of hours, but here we are, we've got 3 guys within this window, they've got elevated levels of TB4. It'd be open to CAS to consider that further evidence that thymus and beta 4 was being used.
Do we know who the players were? We don't have to mention them, but do we know who they were?
Yes, yeah, we know who they are, because as part of then building their defence, the lawyers for the players were able to go back through and go through the medical history of these players and so forth and see whether there was any explanation for why they might have elevated samples.
So on the back of all of this now, Chip, if they were found guilty tomorrow, if they are found guilty tomorrow, they just come off the SMS, is it then now the players, what do they do at the club? They just roll over and just cop this, or do they sue, or, you know, where do the players go from here?
Well, look, if players were to be given substantial penalties for this, substantial suspensions, then you would expect lawsuits. I think that's, Essendon would expect lawsuits in those circumstances, because look, until now, it's been hard. I mean, if you're gonna sue someone, you need to show that it's cost you something. You need to show loss.
Yes.
And at this stage, even though we can see how much these guys
hasn't
have lost
them financially,
but in terms of a material loss, showing that you have to sit out of the game for 12 weeks or 6 months or whatever it is, now that's clearly a material loss, and they would absolutely have a case against the club.
Okay, so they had these 3 elevated samples which strengthen the case that the Court of Arbitration for Sport is hearing. Anything else?
Or so we thought. So the sting in this tale,
right,
is that then having then been confronted with these elevated samples, the lawyers for the players said, well, hang on, what are we comparing this to? When you say these are elevated compared to what? And so what the same lab in Cologne then did, they took a further series of samples from AFL players who weren't at Essendon, so there was in total 54 samples. So these are players.
Are they random players, or you know these names
random,
as well?
Now these, we don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know who these players are.
Mm.
They're from all clubs. None of them, as far as we know, have anything to do with Dank or anything to do with the Essendon supplements program. And about a third of those players returned elevated samples for thymus and beta 4, and some of those samples were elevated beyond those of the Essendon samples. So, so that threw the whole cat among the pigeons, and really, in the end of it, the test has been shown to be not very reliable. That thymus and beta 4 is something that occurs naturally in the body. One of the difficulty things with that is then determining, okay, how much can you naturally have versus how much shows that you've had it injected.
Yep.
Mm.
And what it suggests is that there's certain circumstances, like, for instance, if you have a chronic knee injury or something like that, thymus and beta 4 is associated with healing, that you can have a naturally very high occurring level in your body. So whatever happens tomorrow, those elevated samples are unlikely to have a big bearing one way or the other.
So they're basically then, okay, so they haven't got those elevated samples to use, the World Anti-Doping Authority, so they basically had to prosecute the same case, use the same evidence that they did in the first place.
It's largely the same case. That's, look, the elevated samples are still part of their case, but as I said, I don't think it's going to have a huge weight for the reasons we've just discussed. So same evidence, same burden of proof, same standard of proof, but second time round, they've just been better at presenting it in a more kind of coherent way. And we go back to things that we've talked about for a couple of years, like the text messages between Robinson and Dank, where they're talking about thymus and being important to what they're doing at Essendon. And you're talking about the text messages between Shane Charter, the pharmacist, Nima Lavi, the pharmacist, and Shane Charter, the drug importer, about Dank needing thymus and beta 4 to be prepared next. The consent forms, of course, that all 34 signed, where they agree to be administered by with a thymus and peptide. So these are the string of circumstantial evidence or pointers to TB4 being used at the club that Wider's relying on.
And Wider used different lawyers, obviously, than the ones that were presenting the first case.
Yeah, so they basically threw their best lawyer at the case, which is Richard Young, a lawyer based in Colorado Springs, who was involved in the prosecution of Lance Armstrong and Floyd Landis and others, Marion Jones, very experienced in anti-doping cases. So he flew out from the States to be the lead counsel in the case, and by all accounts...
He was very serious about it.
Oh, yeah. They really went hard at this. And the reason they did is because they felt that the decision of the AFL tribunal, if left to stand, set the bar far too high in terms of the standard of proof, what they call comfortable satisfaction. You need to be comfortably satisfied that something's happened. They felt that the AFL tribunal just set that bar too high, and that needed to be addressed. So they've gone hard at this case.
Court of Arbitration for Sport will hand down its decision on the Essendon 34 tomorrow. We will know this time tomorrow. Couple of calls. Adam on the road has been waiting on. G'day, Adam.
Hey, boys. How you going?
Good, mate.
Good, Adam.
First of all, I'm an Essendon supporter, so I'll put that on the table up front. A question to Chip, and it's a two-part or two-scenario question. Okay, we take it that they get found guilty or not guilty. In either circumstance, what part does the media now have to play? Are the media able to be sued or anything by players for, you know, being accused of doing something that's proven that they haven't done, and then vice versa? You know, I mean, do we open a can of worms no matter what verdict is handed down?
Well, of course, it's always open to anyone to sue the media if they feel like they've been slandered. And there is no doubt that among the Essendon players, some have been absolutely furious at times with the media coverage of this instance and felt like they've been judged early and on sort of insufficient evidence. Look, whether or not they would sue, that's really a question for them. I'd say it would be more likely that if they were to take legal action, it would be against their own club, who is the body responsible for hiring Stephen Dank, hiring Dean Robinson, exposing the players to what happened in 2012.
Mm. And I suppose, that's an interesting one. That's if they're found not guilty, the feeling is that they just, that's good. Let's just get on with our lives, and there's no litigation anywhere.
I reckon if they were not guilty, I reckon they can't forget this thing quick enough.
Yep.
I just think, having lost 3 years of their career, they just want to move on as quickly as possible.
As we spoke about off air before, and a lot of people, and this is what a lot of people come through on the SMS, and they ring up, how can, when there's no positive test yet, how can these players be found guilty?
And we'll get it again if they're found guilty tomorrow.
How can they be found guilty with no positive test? Well, how is that?
Well, I mean, this is what they call a non-analytical test. So when you haven't got a positive test, it's a non-analytical test. And then it becomes a whodunit. It becomes a matter of building a case based on other evidence, on circumstantial evidence. Lance Armstrong never tested positive to drugs.
By people coming and saying, yes, he was
thrown out of cycling. I mean, Marion Jones didn't fail a drugs test. Drug cheats don't always fail drug tests.
Yep.
So it's certainly not unprecedented for why to pursue a case where there isn't a positive test. What's different about this case is that it's a team sport where you've got 34 guys all playing for the same club. To my knowledge, there hasn't been a case involving team doping, if you like, that hasn't had a positive test. So this is the novel thing about this case is we're talking about a team sport, and that raises a whole bunch of questions in terms of really how suited the World Anti-Doping Code is to a team sport. If I could just for an example, you guys might remember early in the piece there was a lot of argument about whether or not these guys had no fault or negligence.
Yep.
In other words, the players were not at fault at all for what happened at Essendon. In the World Anti-Doping Code, the fine print that explains no fault and no negligence says that even in circumstances where an athlete is deliberately sabotaged by his own coach or his own doctor, the athlete is still responsible for that because he chooses who his coach is and who his doctor is. Now, in football, players don't even get to choose where they play. They get drafted. Mm. They get sent around the country as teenagers. They don't have any choice over who their team doctor is, any choice over who the people
their
are
coach
hired
or
by
who's
the club.
Employing,
So it's a really different circumstance than, say, if you're being a track and field athlete or even a swim coach and you have a much bigger say around who the people are that you trust with your food and drink.
You might go to a coach that's known as a bit of a maverick or whatever, and you're
right. It's your decision.
Dennis in Oakley's got a question. 94291116 if you want to pose a question to Chip. G'day, Dennis.
Yeah, good morning, boys. Chip, there was an article under your byline in the paper in the Australian at the weekend, and one of the things it raised or pointed out was Doc Reed actually appeared at the hearing. For Cass, and I hadn't heard that before, and I would have thought that Doc Reed, considering the amount of criticism that he's copped, will have quite a lot swinging on this himself, you know, professionally. And the other point I would like to make is to reinforce the Essendon position on the TB4 naturally occurring. Not with TB4, but with EPO. There was a skier from Scandinavia, I think it was, or Finland rather, and he had in his body naturally occurring EPO, triple what normal people have.
Mm.
And they found this to be naturally occurring because they checked 200 members of his family. So the point that Essendon are making, that sometimes natural things like TB4 the body can manufacture, in a sense, is supported by what happened back in the 60s.
Yep. What about the Doc Reed question that Dennis asked?
Yeah, so Doc Reed did give evidence in front of Kaz. So he testified along with, there was about seven Essendon players who also gave evidence. In terms of what he has riding on, it's pretty much the same as everyone else at Essendon. I mean, Reed's always been horrified at the notion that players under his care were given a banned substance. And obviously, if they were found to have taken TB4, that he'd be absolutely distraught by that. In terms of how much is riding on it for him, because Bruce Reed's a doctor, there have already been parallel investigations that have gone on. For example, APRA, which is the health regulator, has had a good hard look at all the doctors that were involved in what you might call the supplement saga, in terms of the ones up in Cronulla in New South Wales, and also the various doctors that were involved here in Victoria. And the investigation went for about 2 years, and they cleared Bruce Reed of any wrongdoing. Mm. So in terms of his professional duties, he's already been cleared by the relevant body. This, what happens tomorrow is much more a matter for the players.
Thanks for that, Dennis. Brian in Bayswater has a question as well. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, good morning. I was just wondering if I could ask Chip a question, please.
Yes, go ahead.
Fire away, Brian.
Yeah, good morning, Chip. First of all, I'd just like to say thank you very much for the investigative work you've done in this. At least you're a voice that is worth listening to. With regard to the worst case scenario for the Essendon Football Club and the players of the Essendon Football Club, and saying they're found guilty, and it's recommended that they have spent 12 months out of the game, can the AFL have some influence over how that is to be designed in terms of whether there's going to be whether they will get a less of a penalty or more of a penalty?
No, so let's extend it further, Brian. So if you talk about a worst case scenario, the worst case scenario is that you have 34 current and former players who each have a 2-year ban.
Mm.
I mean, that's the mandatory penalty for taking a banned substance. That's what they're looking at. Now, if you had circumstances where you have 12 current Essendon players and also four players at another four AFL clubs who are all given a 2-year ban, this is a huge problem for the AFL. The AFL and its submissions to WADA, the AFL were a party, they submitted that given the length of time, given the disruption to these players' career, and most importantly, given their limited culpability for what went on at Essendon in that 2012 season, the players should have no effective penalty.
Mm.
So the AFL position is that the players have been punished enough for what happened, largely outside their control. So if Kaz came down and said, well, these guys are going to serve a 2-year ban, then that would raise all sorts of issues for the AFL. Not least among them would be they would have to seriously contemplate whether remaining as adherence to the World Anti-Doping Code is in the best interest of their sport.
And we could see a scenario tomorrow where all players are found guilty and there's no penalty to serve, there's no suspension to serve.
Look, there's a full range of possibilities. I mean, we're talking about the 34 as if they're a job lot, and that is how WADA approached this case. It's one in all in as far as WADA's concerned, but that might not be how Kaz read this thing.
Mm.
There was important differences in the testimony that the AFL players gave to the ASADA investigators in the first instance. There were six Essendon players who had recollections of being administered something called thymosin.
Yep.
It's completely open that Kaz might find that on the basis of that alone, it's satisfied that these players were given thymosin beta 4 and not the other. So it could
so the ones that had a better memory.
So the smarter lads, the older guys usually.
The ones who asked the questions, who did a bit of due diligence, they could pay a penalty for that. So there's a possibility that there may be different outcomes for the different players.
Chip LeGrand is with us. The Court of Arbitration for Sport will hand down its decision tomorrow. We'll know by this time tomorrow morning on the Essendon 34. Lots of positive stuff coming through for you, Chip. Thank you, Chip, for all the facts. The conversation this morning is the most knowledgeable and objective that I've heard from anyone in 3 years. That's Darren in Vermont.
Just one for you, Chip. And we have a lot of Essendon supporters who are very angry with the AFL. Extremely angry, blaming the AFL. The AFL did this. Now, have the AFL got anything to answer for if the players are found non-guilty tomorrow?
Well, I'd say the AFL have got plenty to answer for, but not so much on tomorrow's verdict. I mean, really, tomorrow's verdict's about what happened at the club in 2012. And although the AFL had there was a couple of moments where the AFL might have intervened a bit earlier and warned the club about Stephen Dank. Really, what happened at Essendon in 2012 is Essendon's responsibility.
Yeah.
Mm. So the anger that Essendon supporters feel towards the AFL was much more about what happened after the fact.
Yeah.
It was much more about how they handled the investigation, the commission hearing where they felt that the club and players were basically sort of railroaded into a contrived settlement where they accepted the penalties and Essendon got booted out of the 2013 final series. Mm. The notion that the AFL was trying to kind of do deals with Essendon, with ASADA, to try to get this thing wrapped up as it likes to do. So I think it's all reasonable for Essendon supporters and indeed, you know, football supporters generally to be annoyed at the AFL for that, but not so much about what happened.
Well, in your opinion, did the AFL just balls it up after with all those deals that they were trying to make and everything that happened after the initial report?
Well, look, the AFL instinct is always to try to control an outcome. Mm. But this was an outcome that they really couldn't control, as we're seeing tomorrow. Whatever Kaz decides tomorrow has nothing to do with the AFL. They've had no influence on this, really, other than just giving, you know, submissions at the hearing. I think that the AFL's the mistake that they made was to conflate their commercial interests and also the image of the game interests and those sort of things with an anti-doping investigation. It should have been kept separate. Like whatever happened, whatever the AFL wanted to do with Essendon in terms of their failings of governance and management or whatever, that should have been kept separate from whatever was going on in the anti-doping investigation. The AFL shouldn't have been meddling at all in an anti-doping investigation. Yeah.
Back to your calls, 94291116. If you've got a question for Chip, Arthur's in Montmorency. Hi, Arthur.
Hi, how are you going?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, look, I've got a question that's been, on my mind since this whole thing started that no one's really asked. It just seems incredible to me in today's age that there are no records and that it's awfully convenient for them to say that there are no records and that everyone's blaming Stephen Dank and everything. And okay, there might be an issue there, but for me, a club like Essendon, who's been around for a long time and knows the drug, environment we're in, it's just, to me, it's just incredible that they don't have records. And by the way, a lack of records should equal guilt. Then you've got no argument.
Was that just an Essendon thing at the time? Obviously, clubs have really looked at how they keep records post that. But do you think that could have been not just an Essendon thing, that in other sports and maybe other clubs that record keeping wasn't as good as it could have been?
Well, I mean, the thing that tends to characterise all the, if we call the real high performance stuff, and Cam could give some first hand experience on this, is there is some secrecy around this stuff. I mean, clubs, you talk about the because of the salary cap, because of the draft, because of the other things that even out the competition, the one area where clubs feel like they can spend and do something different and get an edge is in medical and conditioning. Mm. And so, and clubs are very protective at what they're doing.
Because now you have to put everything on paper now, don't you, for the AFL?
Look, they've beefed up the reporting, but at the same time, I don't think clubs are in a hurry to really declare everything that they're doing. And we shouldn't be suspicious about that. It's just that clubs, if they find out that, like whatever Hawthorn was doing for their medical conditioning last year, you'd have 17 other clubs who want to do the same thing, because let's do what the Hawks are doing, because they're the best in football. So there's always that nature of they call it protecting IP, protecting intellectual property. And of course, that's where, if you go back to those consent forms that the players were asked to sign, and remember, there was a confidentiality clause. Now, with the benefit of hindsight and other things that we now know, we look at those skeptically. We say, well, hang on, how come they're asked to keep quiet about this? That's suspicious. What was going on there? But what Stephen Dank would say and what Essendon say was, no, this is actually not uncommon for a football club to want to keep wraps on what it's doing and its medical and conditioning.
In your research and in your findings, Chip, what kind of a man is Stephen Dank?
Well, he's the smartest man in the room, in every room he walks into. And so he can be, difficult to deal with. He tends to have 100 things on the go. Described to me as a bit like a frog on a lily pad, always hopping from one to the next. Mm. Very difficult to pin down.
How did he get so far in so many sports with his reputation?
Well, that's it. I mean, Stephen Dank basically worked his way up through professional sport. He's been involved for about 20 years. Like you go back and some of his earliest dealings that I could pick up with a NRL club goes back to St. George before the merger with Illawarra. So we're talking about 20 years back where he came on at a very low level, just sort of one of those guys that kind of would turn up to training, fill the water bottles, went on to sort of help with the sort of rehab sprints and that kind of stuff and got his start that way. He is well qualified. He is a biochemist. He does have postgraduate qualifications in physiology, and so he knows a lot about this stuff.
Mm.
And look, the players talk about that, in their testimony. They said, "Well, look, we thought he was knowledgeable. We thought he knew what he was doing." Some people thought he's a guru. There's no doubt that Dean Robinson, who is his direct boss at Essendon, thought Stephen Dank was an absolute guru in this area. Mm. That he was the best person in Australia as far as recovery goes.
Sell ice to Eskimos.
Pardon me?
He could sell ice to Eskimos?
Well, he could. And this is the problem where, Stephen Dank, he did know some things, but what he failed to know were the things he didn't know. He didn't acknowledge what the limitations of his expertise were. And for instance, at Cronulla, he gave the Cronulla players two band peptides, the CJC1295 and also the GHRP6, in the mistaken belief that they were permitted in sport. They weren't. I mean, he gave those players a band peptide and he cost them all a manner of grief because he didn't understand the world anti-doping code as well as he thought he did. So the AFL Tribunal described Dank as being characterised more by ineptitude rather than malevolence. In other words, he wasn't evil. He just wasn't as good as his job as he thought he was.
And it's one of those things, Moons, and we were talking about it during the break, there are a lot of these types of people that meet with football clubs, Chip, that obviously footy clubs, sporting clubs in general are looking for an edge, and there are a lot of, you know, there'd be footy clubs in the off-season that have met with all types of people trying to get an edge. They've got something to sell.
Goes overseas. That's right. Let's go to the NFL clubs. Let's go to the EPL clubs. Everyone's trying to find an edge and see what everyone else is doing differently.
But of course, at Essendon, what happened was that whatever edge that they felt that they had in 2012, it got blunted pretty quickly because remember that it was only by midway through the season they had all sorts of injury problems.
The program got cut, didn't it?
And the program basically was all but shut down. And this is what Joe Watson's told Asada about Stephen Dank, and this is interesting. He says, "We lost faith. The lack of reporting was concerning. His lack of, I suppose, when he would come to you and say, oh, look, you need to have your shot today, and you'd say, no, you did me yesterday, and he'd just walk off. I think the players started to, as they do, just started to question a little bit, and then also the fact that the injuries that we were sustaining, the performance that we were sustaining as well, meant that I lost faith in the program." So this is from Joe Watson. Now, from what I understand, Joe Watson didn't have any injections from Dank after May in 2012. Mm-hmm. So it was quite early that he called.
So he said,
I'm
not a part of this.
You know what? There was no suspicion that he was cheating. But it was just more. It's not working. Where are the records? Yeah. It just seems all over the place. I don't feel comfortable with this.
Yeah. The Court of Arbitration for Sport will be handing down the decision tomorrow on the Essendon 34, early tomorrow morning. And we've got Chip Legrand in the studio. Happy to take a few of your questions. 94291116. He's got the book, The Straight Dope. It is definitely worth a read. Nick is in West Footscray. Got a question. G'day, Nick.
G'day, guys. How are you going?
Good, Nick.
Quick question. We talked about Steve Dank. We've talked about litigation. Why hasn't the line been drawn between somebody actually suing Steve Dank for his lack of, I suppose, you know, records, failure to provide, you know, information when needed?
Suing Steve Dank, is it just all to do with would there be any money there to, as we said before?
Where is he now and what's happened? He's now out of sport altogether, isn't he?
He is out of sport. And Nick makes a good point. He's been very busy as a litigant. He's sued News Corp, which is the company that owns the Australian newspaper, the paper that I write for defamation in New South Wales and Victoria. The last I checked, he was still appealing the decision against him, his life ban from sport. So he's gone before the AFL Appeals Tribunal to get that overturned. He has threatened many, many times.
Just cop that one, wouldn't he? He's unemployable now, surely.
Well, he wouldn't accept that. He has threatened many times to sue Asada, sue the AFL, to take the whole thing before the federal court. Whether or not he will, we'll just see. In terms of whether or not you'd sue Stephen Dank, I mean, Matt makes the point. If you're going to sue someone, you go for the deepest pocket. So rather than just suing Dank, you would sue the Essendon Football Club as his employer. That said, if a player does take legal action, who knows? Perhaps they might sue Stephen Dank and Dean Robinson and the Essendon Football Club.
Well, on the back of if there's a non-guilty verdict tomorrow, does Dank then have grounds to sue on everybody? Because everyone said, well, he's given them this stuff, and everyone said, well, now he's not guilty.
No, because it's because of Stephen Dank's ineptitude and his incompetence that we're here in the first place. I mean, the whole question of what they were given, why on earth don't we have the answer to that now? And that is very much on Stephen Dank's shoulders that we can't say definitively this is what the players were given.
Mm. Thanks for that, Nick. Let's go to Rob on the road. Hi, Rob.
G'day, fellas. How are you this morning?
Good, mate.
Thanks, Rob.
A question for Chip.
Yeah, I do. I'm an upper registered health professional, and just something you said earlier kind of made me want to call up. I've been following the Essendon saga, you know, for a while. I'm not an Essendon supporter. I guess I'm just interested in it, being a sports fan. But you were saying that before there were ARPA investigations into Doc Reid and other people associated with the saga. I'm just curious how that could be, how those ARPA investigations could be cleared, given the poor record keeping, where that's one of the most important things of the role of being an ARPA registered health practitioner.
Yeah, well, I suppose with now I'm having to speculate a little bit here because I don't know the ins and outs of the ARPA investigation. What I do know is that they sat down and interviewed all the doctors and health professionals that they wanted to have a talk to. So they would have got their direct evidence from them in terms of what's gone on. And yes, they would have looked at a lot of the documentation that's central to the case before CAS. But with Doc Reid, the distinction that needs to be made there is that what Dean Robinson and Stephen Dank were doing wasn't Reid's program. Reid says that he approved the use of AOD9604, which was another contentious peptide, in limited circumstances for players who had, say, osteoporosis or so I've got my medical terms.
Osteotis pubis?
A chronic, say, bone degeneration.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay.
Those sort of chronic injuries. So limited use of AOD9604, which in the end isn't being treated as a banned substance for the time in question. He didn't approve the use of thymosin, whether or not it's thymosin beta 4 or thymosin alpha, a permitted kind. The injections, so much of what Stephen Dank was up to was done without Bruce Reid's authority and without Bruce Reid's knowledge. And that's why, if it was with his knowledge, if it was with authority, then absolutely it'd be on him to keep paperwork of this stuff. But what he's saying is that you had a couple of rogue operators in the place that were running their own show.
Coming up to 9 o'clock, a couple of quick questions for Chip. Job Watson and his Brownlow, if Job is found guilty, the chances of him losing his Brownlow, and who makes that decision?
Well, that's an AFL decision. I would think we'll absolutely have the argument. Again, it's inevitable. It'll be raised. I'd be extremely doubtful that the AFL would want to move against Job Watson's Brownlow.
Okay.
And the other one, Chip, just come off the SMS. Any league, doesn't matter what league they're playing in, all players will be suspended.
From country football to the amateurs to the various state leagues. And of course, not just the players, it's people who have assistant coaching roles or anyone who's considered a support person under the World Anti-Doping Code. They won't be able to do those jobs while they're serving a suspension for doping.
Okay, if we find a guilty verdict, if they are guilty tomorrow, your gut feel on what sort of penalty they may receive?
Look, it's just a guess, but I would think 3 months would be at the upper limit of what would be reasonable, given that everyone really on every side of this thing accepts that the players are the least culpable party of what went on.
3 months. Okay. It is tomorrow
Great
we
hour,
hear the
Chip.
Verdict.
Well done.
7:30, the players will find out. Around 8:30, the public will find out. Thank you, Chip, for joining us. The Straight Dope is the book that Chip has written. It is a great read. It's well worth getting hold of. Chip Legrand from The Australian joining us. We'll see you tomorrow.